It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 52 degrees under overcast skies. At the airport, they are now showing southeast winds at 8 miles per hour, 10 miles of visibility, and 80% humidity. The Weather Service continues to call for partly sunny skies today. We haven't seen the sunny part yet. High near 54 today with calm winds turning to the east to 5 this afternoon. For tonight, mostly cloudy, low of 45, southeast to 5. And for tomorrow, just a 20% chance of rain, mostly cloudy skies, high near 53, east winds continuing to 10 or so. However, on Sunday, the rain is expected to set in. That rain could be heavy at times, and it will be accompanied by east winds at 25 to 30 miles per hour on Sunday. Coming up on the Midday Report, Brian Vanwall got to explore an exploratory vessel. He'll tell us about that. And Senator Murkowski is more convinced than ever that aiding Ukraine is the right thing to do.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A sharply divided U.S. Supreme Court has thrown out the Biden administration's student loan forgiveness program, arguing the president overstepped his authority in deciding to waive billions of dollars of debt with taxpayer money. Nebraska is applauding the decision. It led several states in challenging Biden's program. State Attorney General Mike Hilger says any criticism of the court is unfair.
At the end of the day, there's a right way and wrong way of doing things. And the right way is to go through Congress and work through our elected branches to be able to try to have some sort of proposal that would stand constitutional muster. The wrong way is to do it the way the Biden administration would do.
Biden is expected to publicly address the high court's decision shortly. The U.S. Supreme Court has also ruled that the First Amendment protects business owners from having to engage in speech with which they disagree. The case involved a Colorado website designer who declined to create a wedding website for a same-sex couple. NPR's Jason DeRose reports religious liberty groups are at odds over the decision.
The conservative public interest law firm Liberty Counsel calls the 6-3 ruling a huge win for free speech and one that prevails over government coercion. They praise the majority opinion for describing how the First Amendment protects individuals whose ideas some may find repugnant, and that it precludes the government from forcing a speaker, in this case a website designer, to provide a service construed as speech. Meanwhile, the progressive group Americans United for the Separation of Church and State is denouncing the court's decision. The organization says everyone should have equal access to goods and services, regardless of who they love, who they are, or how they worship. Both groups filed amicus briefs in the case. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Russia's foreign minister is playing down last weekend's uprising by the Wagner mercenary against the country's top brass as an insignificant event. The comments coming as Kremlin officials continue to try and limit the political fallout from the rebellion. NPR's Charles Means has more from Moscow.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the Wagner rebellion, which saw the mercenaries quickly seize a major southern Russian city and march on the capital last Saturday, was a minor event inflated by the West. Lavrov said Russia had emerged from the incident stronger and more resilient, adding if the West had doubts about that, it was, quote, their problem. In the wake of the Wagner rebellion, the Kremlin has sought to present President Vladimir Putin as having been firmly in control, despite offering the mercenaries amnesty in exchange for withdrawing their fighters. Putin has also argued the rebellion ultimately failed because Russian society and the country's security forces united behind the government in support of law and order. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
U.S. stocks end the day higher with the Dow up 285 points. This is NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. An exploratory vessel mapping the seafloor along Alaska's coast docked in Kodiak last weekend. The crew of the Okeanos Explorer was in town to restock supplies before they went back to logging fault lines along the Aleutian chain. KMXT's Brian Venois climbed aboard the vessel to see how they collect and publish data in some of the most remote areas in the world.
Seawater temperature is 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Shore wind is 300.5 knots.
The ship is a bit smaller than the Coast Guard cutter Alex Haley, which is docked right across from the exploratory vessel at the end of the pier. The Okeanos Explorer is operated by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's in Alaska as part of an international effort called Seabed 2030 to map the entire seafloor by the end of the decade. Casey Cantwell is the operations chief for NOAA Ocean Exploration and guides tours aboard the vessel. She says the crew discovers new things almost every time they launch an expedition.
We have better maps of Mars than we do actually of our own ocean. We know so little about the deep sea. As a whole, we know very little about the ocean. We're still learning every day, but particularly the deep sea is largely unknown and unexplored.
Colin Little is an officer of the NOAA Corps and captains the ship.
Standard helm, kind of a Mario Kart helm, right? That's left and right, just like a car.
Little has led the ship for over a year now. He says expeditions usually range between 3 to 4 weeks before they shore up to restock on food, like fruits and vegetables.
Some of these places that we're going are super far-flung and hard to get to, so there's a lot of transit involved, and it's just getting the most bang for our buck is instead of getting there, being there for 2 days and coming back, it's like, let's be there and stay there for 20 days.
While they're at sea, the crew has access to satellite internet anywhere. They use it to keep up with loved ones on land, but scientists also use that connection to publish their data for the public online. Thomas Morrow is a physical scientist for NOAA. He's part of the team that reads and compiles data as it's published.
On our website, it is updated daily, so every day that we are out and we collect new information, that new data appears, and you can actually watch our expeditions live in real time.
That new data could include information about any new species they find. Scientists also publish temperature data as well as drafts of the seafloor maps they're creating. Those maps are primarily generated via sonar that can scan a spread of around 10 kilometers in some depths. But that isn't their only tool. The Okeanos Explorer is also equipped with robots capable of diving about 6,000 meters. That's nearly 4 miles below the water surface, or about as deep as Denali is tall. One of the robots is about the size of a small car. It has arms to collect samples, as well as cameras and lights to find deep sea flora and fauna, or even explore caves on the ocean floor. Cantwell, the vessel's operations chief, say they never get tired of exploring, and that it's a dream job for anyone interested in careers in marine science.
One day we'll be diving on a shipwreck, the next day we'll be on these beautiful coral gardens, the next day we'll be on a hydrothermal vent, the day after that we'll be diving on a steep wall looking to see if there's been any slope failures. It is really, truly incredible.
The crew expects to finish their adventures in Alaska this fall. Their next expedition will take them to Hawaii next year. Aboard the Okeanos Explorer, I'm Brian Benoit.
Senator Lisa Murkowski was in NATO allies Lithuania and Norway last week, just as a mercenary boss launched a march on Moscow. Murkowski says her visit has strengthened her resolve to continue U.S. aid for Ukraine's defense.
We can't get soft on our support for Ukraine. These people have demonstrated a resilience and a commitment to freedom that is unparalleled in modern times. And the United States and our allies need to be there with them.
The U.S. has already spent more than $77 billion on military, financial, and humanitarian assistance for Ukraine since 2022. Some members of Congress have called for spending restraints, saying the aid for Ukraine could escalate the conflict and risks creating a proxy war with Russia. Murkowski calls the funding an investment in freedom. The Alaska Bureau of Investigation is looking into the fatal shooting by law enforcement officers of a heavily armed man who on Wednesday barricaded himself in his own home near Esther. An Alaska State Trooper news release says the incident began Tuesday when 54-year-old Matthew Heller threatened a woman at his home with a rifle. She escaped unharmed and reported the threat. Troopers went to the residence near Standard Creek to talk with Heller, but they left after observing that he was heavily armed and had barricaded himself in his house. Trooper spokesperson Austin McDaniel says the troopers' Northern Special Emergency Reaction Team, or CERT, went to Heller's home then again the next day with an arrest warrant.
So the Alaska State Troopers' Northern CERT team arrived at the residence right around 6:45 on Wednesday night.
The news release says the CERT team members saw that Heller had again barricaded himself in the house and had piled up some sandbags in front of doorways to prevent anyone from entering.
There was sandbags stacked about 4 feet high on the outside of the residence, kind of near doors.
McDaniel said Thursday that troopers and CERT members tried to negotiate with Heller over the next 3 hours to get him to come out of the house unarmed. At 10 p.m., officers saw Heller point a firearm at one of the CERT officers, and in response, several officers fired their weapons, fatally wounding him. The news release says officers unsuccessfully tried to keep him alive, but he was declared dead at the scene. Climate change is changing the Gulf of Alaska, but in vast stretches of the ocean, a lack of data makes it hard for researchers to know how important species like salmon are handling that change. Now, two new citizen science programs will shed some light on the subject with a fleet of Southeast trawlers whose fishing boats will double as research vessels.
There was sandbag.
Eric Brewer's life on the ocean began more than 70 years ago when his parents started taking him out on the family's trawler. At 73, Brewer still fishes out of Sitka, but he says a lot has changed in the waters of Southeast Alaska.
I was out there yesterday and seeing things that are truly dystopic. The lack of birds, the lack of fish in Salisbury Sound.
Brewer started his own operation in 1978, trolling for coho and chinook. In those days, he'd catch thousands of fish. But today, the ocean seems less abundant.
Those of us who are out there on the water, we are seeing the changes. And I'll tell you, it's pretty spooky.
In recent years, most species of Southeast salmon have had record low harvests. And the devastation still lingers from a Pacific marine heat wave known as the Blob that caused massive die-offs of marine animals. Scientists expect a future with warmer oceans and more marine heat waves that could rock the ocean ecosystem in Southeast Alaska. But major data gaps make it hard for them to determine how changing conditions might threaten the health of important species like salmon. With two new citizen science programs from Alaska Sea Grant and the Alaska Troller Association, scientists will get a hand from some people who know the salmon best, Southeast Alaska's troll fishing fleet. The first project will outfit boats with sensors to measure temperature and salinity. Tyler Hennen is an oceanographer at the University of Fairbanks. He says those two measurements are the heartbeat of the ocean.
Figuring out how temperature and salinity change over time and space gives you some clues on how the water is circulating around Southeast Alaska.
Knowing how the water circulates gives scientists a better idea of how food is circulating too. For instance, mixing ocean water triggers phytoplankton blooms,
which of course is the base of the food chain and sets off the production for all the higher trophic levels and fishing and all the things that we love.
Fishermen will take measurements at different depths along their fishing routes, and over time, the data will form a baseline. That will help researchers to determine what's normal and what might be linked to climate change. And for fishermen like Jim Moore, that data could add important context to decades of observations out on the water.
People talk about, oh my goodness, I've never seen that before. Well, I've been fishing 53 years. I saw that back in 1979. I saw it again in 1983. And, you know, the long-term data set is what's really valuable.
Back in the 70s, he participated in a logbook program where fishermen studied salmon populations in the Gulf of Alaska. This spring, Moore and a select group of fishermen have relaunched the program electronically. They'll record things like the species and number of salmon they're catching, where they catch them, the size of the fish, and their stomach contents.
Fishermen are natural scientists, and the trust built between management and science and the fishermen, I think, is a good thing, because we're all working on it together.
Back in Sitka, Eric Brewer will be testing out the logbook program on his boat this summer. And he says, for fishermen, collaborating with scientists is a long game.
Trawlers have a long history of standing up for salmon, and we are going to do that.
Through these citizen science programs, Southeast troll fishermen can further solidify their role as environmental stewards. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
Communities throughout southeast Alaska have been waiting and watching for the Hokulea to arrive in their town. The double-hulled traditional voyaging canoe is on a years-long global journey with roots in indigenous knowledge. But how is the 62-foot canoe getting around? As KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, once the canoe hits deeper waters, the crew will be using traditional navigation methods.
The Polynesian Voyaging Society's Moana Nui Akea is all about a return to tradition, spreading care for the ocean, teaching and cultivating indigenous knowledge, connecting with other cultures, and using traditional methods. Planetary navigation is a part of that. Lucy Lee is a Hokulea crew member and a self-described student of the canoe.
To me, voyaging in general, but also the navigation, is just a testament to how ingenious our ancestors were.
Part of what non-instrument navigation means is using something called a star compass. Lee says the head of the Polynesian Voyaging Society, Nanoa Thompson, created the version that's used on the Hokulea after learning from a navigator from Micronesia. The navigator who taught Thompson had a version of the compass that was passed down through generations and from teacher to teacher.
So the star compass represents a lot of things, but its main use is as a navigational tool to figure out where celestial bodies are setting and rising, to determine where the canoe is heading, where the wind is coming from, where the tide is coming from, where the swell is coming from. So it really is just like any other compass. It helps to align all of the things that we're observing so that you have a sense of direction.
Information from the Polynesian Voyaging Society describes the star compass as a mental construct. Lee says it's something that exists within a navigator, but it can be used in a physical form to help teach people too.
So we do have like physical manifestations of that we use to help explain to people. But for the navigator, they really do have so much information and knowledge within their own head. And so one of those things is just like being able to mentally picture and use the star compass.
There's a compass on the canoe too, but it's not what most people would expect.
The one on the canoe doesn't have any labels because depending on which direction the canoe is pointed, which direction the navigator is placed in, the orientation of the compass changes with the orientation of the canoe and the orientation of whoever's navigating. But it allows you to see those distinct houses, we call them, which are the eight sections within the four houses. Well, there's the four cardinal points and then seven sections within each quadrant.
She says the crew hasn't started to use those methods yet, but they will in time.
As we've been beginning the voyage, there hasn't been a lot of what people probably think of non-instrumental navigation as because of the safety of the canoe and our crew. But when we get into some of the later legs of the voyage, there will be a lot of focus on the teaching of that and the use of that as we navigate deeper waters.
Right now, the crew is relying on technology along with locals and other helpful people on the water. They'll turn to traditional wayfinding in deeper waters. For Lee, gearing up to use these traditional methods is just another way to feel closer to her ancestors. It's a special experience that reminds her of the resilience and wisdom of the indigenous navigators who came before her.
I think voyaging is one of the traditional practices or traditional things that we do that we feel like we're doing exactly what our ancestors did. I think there's been a lot of growth and a lot of change to the original practices that our ancestors did, especially with cultural loss and colonization and just the struggle of trying to keep these things relevant and alive.
And when she's on the canoe, Lee says that a breeze or a drop of rain can remind her that one of her ancestors was in the exact same spot years ago. In Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
A phone sat at the bottom of the Kenai River for about 4 days last week. But as KDLL's Riley Board reports, this story has a happy ending.
This weekend on the Upper Kenai, one angler caught something even rarer than a king salmon.
And she snagged something, and at first we thought it was a trout because of the way it was kind of wiggling in the water, and it wasn't pulling as hard as a salmon. And I saw her just reel this like black object out of the water. And it turned out to be an iPhone.
David Finocchio of Anchorage was fishing on the Kenai River with his mom, who was visiting from the East Coast. Just as Finocchio was reeling in a salmon, his mom pulled up the cell phone, clad in a high-tech case.
The tip of her hook had just like barely snagged the lip or like the edge of the case. And so she reeled it up and we were like, wow, what are the chances of that? That's amazing. It's probably, you know, toast.
Finocchio brought the phone home to Anchorage, plugged it in, and miraculously, it came back to life. The home screen pictured a couple skiing at Alyeska Resort, so he knew it had to belong to a local. He posted on Facebook and quickly reconnected with the owner. It turned out the phone had been at the bottom of the river for 4 days. Finocchio says everything about the process feels miraculous.
I bet if there was a phone in the bottom of the river and you were like, you could see it, you'd have a really hard time hooking it, even if you were trying. And so the fact just that she got it alone was like, that was enough for us. And then, you know, to think that we'd ever be able to like return it to its owner was definitely beyond what we thought was going to be possible that day.
He says, well, it was a successful salmon fishing day for him. His mom ultimately just caught the phone. The Russian River and Upper Kenai River opened to sport fishermen a month early, and the bag limit increased last weekend, bringing an influx of anglers. The river reached its escapement goal with 2 weeks left in the early run. In Kenai, I'm Riley Board.
The Supreme Court blocked the Biden administration's student loan forgiveness program. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute. The 6-3 ruling from the High Court sided with the state of Missouri's claim that it would be negatively impacted financially if the Biden administration forgave all or part of the student loan debt of some 40 million Americans. The High Court said the executive branch did not have the authority. The court voted along the same 6-3 ideological lines that a Colorado-based web designer who wants to refuse to create pages for same-sex weddings is protected by the First Amendment. Neil Gorsuch delivered the majority opinion and said that state governments can't compel speech. And the Federal Reserve's closely watched inflation gauge, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, fell to 3.8% in May. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon, and welcome to your Island Messenger for Friday. It is the 30th day of June, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 5:12. It will set again at 11:13. That will give us 18 hours and 1 minute of daylight, a loss of 1 minute and 17 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high for this date was 76 degrees, set in 1968, and our record low is 38 degrees, set in 1952. Currently is 52 degrees under overcast skies. Out at the airport, they are showing southeast winds at 8 miles per hour, and they have 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service has been calling for partly sunny skies today with a high near 54. Calm winds turning to the east to 5, mostly cloudy overnight with a low of 46, southeast winds to 5, and just a 20% chance of rain for Saturday with mostly cloudy skies and a high near 53, light easterly winds tomorrow too. But on Sunday, the rain is expected to begin. That rain could be heavy at times, high near 53 on rainy, rainy Sunday, and east winds increasing to 25 to 30 miles per hour. Monday, just a 50% chance of rain, cloudy skies. And for Tuesday, just a chance of rain. Same forecast for Wednesday. So maybe a nice fourth. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up at 12:59 here on the east side. That will be a 5.7-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 5:47 p.m. of 2.9 feet. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 1:18 this afternoon and be 10.5 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 6:43 p.m. of 4.2 feet. Let's see what the Department of Fish and Game has to say.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement Number 11, date issued 10 a.m. on June 27th. Cost recovery fisheries are scheduled to begin in Spirit and Bay Special Harvest Area at noon Tuesday, June 27th, and the Spirit and Bay Special Harvest Area will remain closed to common property fishing. Fishery opportunities in the Spirit and Bay Special Harvest Area will depend on the ability to meet local aquaculture association needs, and all cost recovery information may be obtained by calling 486-6559. The Iziwit Bay section of the Afognak District will close to commercial salmon fishing at 9 p.m. Wednesday, June 28th. And as previously announced, there will be a 57-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, June 27th to 9 p.m. Thursday, June 29th in the following areas. In the Cape Alatak, Humpy Deadman, Alatak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alatak District. And the following areas remain open until further notice. The Duck Bay section of the Afognak District and the Fowl Bay Special Harvest Area and the Waterfall Bay Special Harvest Area. Fishermen are reminded that in the Kodiak area, including the mainland district, until further notice, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Closed waters are reduced until further notice in the following locations: in Fowl Bay to the stream terminus at Hidden Lake Creek, stream number 251406, and in Waterfall Bay to the stream terminus at Little Waterfall Creek, stream number 251822, and to the stream terminus at Big Waterfall Creek, stream number 251821. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak area salmon statistical chart, detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations, and statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game office. And of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour record phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
And mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory for tomorrow on our east side. For today, east 15, seas to 4 feet. Same forecast for tonight. For tomorrow, east 30, seas to 5 feet, building to 9 feet Saturday night. And for Sunday, on our east side, southeast 30, seas to 10 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory for tomorrow there as well. Variable 10 today with seas to 3 feet. Northeast 15 tonight with 3-foot seas. And for tomorrow in the Shelikof, northeast 20, increasing to 30 knots in the afternoon, 5-foot seas building to 8 feet in the afternoon. And for Saturday night in the Shelikof, northeast 35, seas to 11 feet. For Sunday, east 35, and seas to 11 feet. Don't forget, tonight is the big drag show at Tony's Bar. There's a $10 cash cover, and doors open at 8. Show starts at 9 p.m. That's tonight at Tony's Bar.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the June 30th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. As I reached for my winter raincoat earlier this week, I reminded myself that there are worse things than a cool start to summer. 90 and smoke-filled skies, for example. Things continue to lag a couple of weeks behind in nature. The lupin are blooming along the roadsides in some areas nicely, but in some meadows it seems that many of the plants bolted before blooming, and the spires of flowers that are about to bloom are super tall and really skinny. It'll be interesting to see what they look like in the next couple of weeks. In the meantime, pushkey, ferns, devil's club, and the grasses are getting a little fuller, and the alders love this weather. Kodiak is greening up all the way to the tops of the mountains, finally. Along with the green growth, the mosquitoes, gnats, and flies are appearing. It might be a good year to put your bug net in your day pack when out on adventures. Speaking of adventures, there are two parades to enjoy again this 4th of July, one here in town and one in Chiniac. In town, the parade begins at 11 a.m. downtown. The route goes from the Spit, left on Marine Way, right on Rezanov, and then down center to go around the block and finish up back at the Spit. If you would like to be in the parade, just show up at the Spit starting at 9 a.m. In Chiniac, there's a potluck at the Chiniac Library at noon. The parade starts at 2 p.m. at Road's End, and all sorts of transport is welcome. Bikes, trikes, strollers, side-by-sides, cars, motorcycles, trucks, and even walkers are welcome to participate in the parade. Both parade celebrations are a lot of fun, and all are welcome. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Happy 4th of July.